find yourself a Bible as we look at that grace. And we're going to find it in a place that's traditionally been more about focused on rules than about grace. But if you look closely enough, you discover the grace precedes the rules. So let's turn to that together. And an act of grace that occurred in Exodus during the that time when the people of Israel left Egypt, stopped being slaves and began for the first time to be a nation. A crucial moment in that story happens in Exodus chapter 12. So if you turn to chapter 12 of Exodus, and let's look at verse 11 together. Exodus chapter 12, verse 11. And we're going to look at chapter 12 and we're going to look at chapter 20 of Exodus today as we look through. But let me read this to you. These were the instructions for that very last plague that passed through Egypt and finally set the people free. "These are your instructions for eating this meal," said the Lord. "Be fully dressed. Wear your sandals and carry your walking stick in your hand. Eat the meal with urgency, for this is the Lord's Passover. And on that night, I will pass through the land of Egypt and strike down every firstborn son and firstborn male animal in the land of Egypt. I will execute judgment against all the gods of Egypt. For I am the Lord. But the blood on your doorposts will serve as a sign, marking the houses where you are staying. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. This plague of death will not touch you when I strike the land of Egypt." And we know the story as that happens, that the people are set free and they finally make their way all the way to Mount Sinai, where Moses goes up and comes back with the law. And in chapter 20 of Exodus, here's the first line of chapter 20. "Then God gave the people all these instructions. And listen to what he said. I am the Lord your God who rescued you from the land of Egypt, the place of your slavery. You must have no other God before me." So we're still in this series together looking at this wonderful theme of redemption. It's called The Story of Redemption. I think the title slide should be up there somewhere. There we go. And we're looking at Once Upon a Time. It's this big story that we're trying to get our head around, that it all links together. 66 books written over hundreds and hundreds of years by over 40 authors, and yet it all tells the same story. It tells the story of redemption, a wonderful story. And we're in part four at the moment, and this is the moment when God goes public, when God's name is not just known by Abraham's family, but when God's name suddenly is known across the known world at that time. And if you hang on to Exodus chapter 20, we'll come back to that story. But remember last week Rod was teaching on Abraham and that part of the story. And you remember there were three promises? Do you remember that? Remember what the promises were? Three promises to Abraham. You will be a great and a great and a great. So a great what? Nation, yeah. Another promise. That is name. Yeah, your name will be great. I'll make your name great. So I'll give it to you. Here you go. There you go. Nation, name, and I will make you a blessing to the whole world. Not just your bit of the world, the whole world. That was the promise. The three promises that were given to Abraham when God revealed himself for the first time to him. All those promises depended on one thing coming true. Abraham, you're going to have a son. Without that, none of this happens. So it was all dependent on him having a son. Well, finally, Abraham has a son. His son was called Isaac, well done. Yeah, all caught you by surprise. It's terrible, isn't it, when he asks you questions and you go, oh, I don't know. It's like countdown all over again. So, yeah. So his name was Isaac. Isaac had a couple of sons. Do you remember their names? Very hairy man. Yeah, they must be done. And Jacob. Jacob and Esau. Jacob had a bunch of sons. I'm not going to ask you those because there were 12 of them. But what was the famous one? Joseph. And through Joseph, where does the family of Abraham end up? Egypt. There you go. And that's where we start the context today. And while they're in Egypt, the descendants of Abraham multiply and grow. And they fulfill that second promise, the first promise, you will be a great nation. They literally grow into a nation while they're in the middle of Egypt there. And a Pharaoh comes along who's worried about all these Hebrews because suddenly they've got a nation within their nation. And that's a security problem. So he enslaves them. He puts them to work building his temples and his monuments and his tributes to his own name. And he enslaves them. For 400 years, the nation of Israel is a slave nation. That's how they start. As a slaves. That's all they've ever known. Now you need to understand they knew nothing about God at this point. The people of Israel knew nothing about the God to whom they belonged. Except that he was the God of their ancestor Abraham. That's all they knew. They had no scriptures. They had no synagogues. They had no teaching. All they knew was that their father, great, great, great grandfather Abraham had met this God. And that was where they came from. That's all they knew. They didn't even know his name. And if you asked a Hebrew slave, is this your God? They would say, well, he's the God of my ancestor Abraham, so I suppose so. Don't know anything about him. But he is our God, I suppose. And for 400 years, God says nothing, does nothing. It's almost embarrassing. 400 years, his people are slaves in Egypt. And what's happened to all those promises? Look at them. None of them are going to happen. I mean, you're not a great nation if you're a bunch of slaves, are you? You're not great. What's happening to the promises? I suspect the people of Israel viewed this whole idea that a powerful God had once upon a time visited their great, 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 great granddad Abraham and declared some amazing promises. I bet they viewed it as a bit of a joke, as a bit of an old wives' tale, as a fairy tale. Wouldn't that be nice if a great, great, great God did actually care about us? And I bet you felt like that. I bet at times when, you know, maybe you've grown up in a Christian home and maybe you've come to Christ yourself, but at times he seems silent and he doesn't seem to be doing anything, and years go by when you feel a bit dry and you feel a bit, you know, and nothing's happening and you're not hearing from him and he seems oblivious to what's going on in your life. You ever felt like that? And what we often do is we draw a conclusion when that happens. God doesn't love me. Here are my circumstances. Therefore, God doesn't love me or care about me. Now, would Israel have been right drawing that conclusion? Well, we would say no, because we know what happens next. But for them, for 400 years, that was what they felt. And I thought long and hard about why would God stay silent for 400 years and not do anything? I can only come up with a few theories. I've got to be honest, I don't really know. I don't really know why he waited that long. And the temptation is to draw conclusions from our circumstances about God. Here are my circumstances, therefore God is like this. Trust me, that's dangerous. Because your circumstances don't represent God. And how wrong the people of Israel would have been if they'd have said, God doesn't care. Time went by, and even in their captivity, the Hebrews just kept growing as a nation, even though they were now slaves. Eventually, another Pharaoh decides to put a stop to this, and this is what he says. He passes a law. All the Hebrew baby boys, all the baby boys born will now be killed. That was what they lived under. and they start throwing Hebrew children into the river. And just as it looked like it couldn't get any worse for this nation, this people who God had appeared to their great, great, great ancestor, God finally steps in. And a baby is born. A baby to a Hebrew from the tribe of Levi, in the forlorn hope of saving this baby, because all the others are being killed. You know the story. The mother places him in a little basket and she pushes him out in the river. And the story goes that eventually he ends up washing up next to Pharaoh's daughter, who takes him into her own family, who adopts him and raises him as her own within Pharaoh's palace. And she calls him Moses. Now this is all a bit odd, isn't it? Let's face it, if you were writing a story and you wanted everybody to believe in your God, you wouldn't write it like this, would you? You wouldn't depict a God like this. I'd never have done it this way. Come on, Lord, we need a deliverer. These people need saving. And you send them a baby. And you take 400 years to do it. I would never have written that. If this is made up, it's badly made up, isn't it? Why is it when we need a nation, you start with a man who can't have kids, God? He did, didn't he? That makes no sense. I wouldn't have done that. Why is it when we need a deliverer, you start with a baby? And in the meantime, another generation of Hebrews dies with no hope. God, what are you doing? And when this baby grows up, one day as he grows up, he sees one of his people. He knows he's not an Egyptian. He knows he's adopted. He knows these are his people. And he sees one of his people being beaten by an Egyptian taskmaster. And he just blows up. He can't take seeing his people treated like this anymore. And he lashes out. And in his anger, he kills this slave driver, this taskmaster. And word gets out. And now he's in trouble because he's adopted. So he doesn't have all the rights of Pharaoh's true sons. So he runs for his life into the desert. And another 40 years goes by. I mean, if I ask you to wait 40 years for something, let alone 400 years for something, what are you going to say to me? I'll sort it out myself, Phil. Seriously, I'll do it myself. 40 years go by. Nothing more happens. Another generation of Hebrew slaves dies with no hope. And that's just not the kind of God I would make up. If the plan was to write something so people would follow God, I'd have skipped all this stuff. But the Bible tells us this is what happens. And after all these delays, for some reason, God then at that moment, for some reason, one crucial moment, he says, this is the time, now I'm going public. Now not my people, but the world will know I am God. And he steps on for the very first time onto the world stage, not just a family stage. Don't forget, this is the first time this had happened. Until now, God has only ever revealed himself to one family. And all of his descendants are wondering whether it was even true. And he appears to Moses in a burning bush and he says, Moses, I want you to go back to Egypt and rescue my people. You know the story, it's a great chapter. Moses basically says, pick someone else. I'm terrified. I don't want to do it. But after all the excuses, God convinces him to go and he sends Aaron, his brother, to help him. And during the discussion, Moses says, suppose I do go back and Pharaoh asks me, who sent you? And this makes you realize how little they understood of this God that belonged to them and they belonged to him. Who sent you? What should I say? Because I don't even know your name. I don't know who you are. And this is what God says, and it's an amazing verse that still stumps us today, isn't it? This is what God says. God replies to Moses, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me. So to clarify, God says, I am who I am. Do you know what that meant? Do you know what that meant? That meant, Moses, I don't even need a name. Because I'm the one, the only, the true, the ultimate reality. I am the only God. So Moses went and he got an audience with Pharaoh and he said, I am has sent you a message. Let my people go. And Pharaoh laughs at him. And the Hebrews mourned. But God smiled. Because the stage was now set to give God a reason to demonstrate he was the only true, real, powerful, gracious God that he really is. He had everything in place to do it. Pharaoh said no, so God sent a plague for each of the things the Egyptians held sacred. It wasn't arbitrary. He picked things that the Egyptians held as gods, and he made a mockery of them. They worshipped the Nile River. The Egyptians worshipped the Nile as a source of life. So God says, you think that's a god? And he turned it to blood. They loved and worshipped the sun. So God said, you worship the sun, you think that's a god? And he blotted it out. They loved and worshipped certain gods in the form of cattle, and he destroyed their cattle. They had a god that came in the form of a frog. And God said, you love frogs so much? Here's a few billion of them. See how you love good frogs after that. Everything the Egyptians held near and dear and worshipped as a god, God made a mockery of it. And in the process, people start to realize there is another god other than Pharaoh. Maybe the god of the Hebrews, the god of the Israelites, maybe he's real. And he steps onto the stage. Here's God's own explanation of why he did all these things. Why he sort of attacked all of their gods. This is what he said. The Lord had said to Moses, Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in Egypt. I want to prove who I am. And I've allowed Pharaoh to say no. So now I have the stage in which to say, let me prove to you who I am. That's what he was doing. And after that, the Hebrews finally left Egypt. God said something very similar to explain what he was doing. He said this, I will harden hearts of the Egyptians and they will charge in after the Israelites. My great glory, again, I'm going public. I want people to see who I really am. My great glory will be displayed through Pharaoh and his troops, his chariots and his charioteers. And when my glory is displayed through them, all Egypt, they're not his people, but all Egypt will see my glory and know that I am the Lord. Egypt was renowned for its army, especially its cavalry. The chariots of Egypt were feared throughout the known world. They were the superpower of their day. It's what gave them their strength and their security in world affairs. They were the biggest, most powerful empire on the globe at the time. And it's as if God was saying, as he dumped their chariots in the Red Sea and annihilated their most powerful assets, it's as if he's saying, I've waited for this moment for a long time. I've waited for one nation, to be so powerful that they ruled everybody. So powerful that they were undisputed ruler of the world. And I've grown my nation right in the middle of them. And now I'm stepping onto the stage to let you know they are nothing compared to me. You could almost see a plan here, couldn't you? You could almost see why God did what he did in the time he did it. He's stepping onto the stage of the world and he's saying, here I am. Not just to a family, but to the world. And God did that just at the Red Sea. And the word got out to the surrounding nations. There's something special about the God of the Hebrews. And by the time Israel, 40 years later, walked into the Promised Land, everybody in the Promised Land had heard of the Hebrews. Everybody had heard of their God. 40 years before, nobody, including the Hebrews, even knew his name. Isn't that amazing? But before they were released, Pharaoh continued to say no. So God says, just one more plague. Just one more plague to get my people free. And he said, you destroyed all the firstborn sons of my people. Pharaoh, I'm going to do the same to you. You say you're a god? Well, I'm a god. A bigger god. And I will destroy all of your firstborn. Not only sons, but your cattle as well. And the tenth plague was the angel of death. But God made a provision in the midst of that. In the midst of that plague. And that provision, by the way, wasn't just for the Israelites. It was for anybody who did it. The Egyptians could have saved themselves. He told the people to kill a spotless lamb, to paint the blood over the tops and sides of the doors, and to stay indoors. It's called the Passover. And here's how the Bible described it, and we read it earlier on. On that night, I will pass through the land of Egypt. I'll strike down every firstborn son and firstborn male animal in the land of Egypt. I will execute judgment, listen to this, against all the gods of Egypt. Because they're not real. I'm going to prove it. I'm the only God. So I'll execute judgment on the gods of Egypt. For I am the Lord. But the blood on your doorpost will serve as a sign, marking the houses where you're staying. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. That's the phrase, pass over. The plague of death will not touch you when I strike the land of Egypt. And because God had at this moment the world's attention, in this moment he also does something very special. He foreshadows, he paints a picture of what's going to happen 1500 years later when Christ, the Redeemer, the one who buys us back, the one who saves us through his blood, appears. He foreshadowed that he would accept people, listen to this, not on the basis that one person is better than another, but on the basis of trust in the blood as protection. Trust in what God has done for us. And the sacrifice of those lambs was a picture of the day when God would send the Lamb of God. That was the first title that Jesus was attached to as he walked down to the Jordan River to be baptized by John the Baptist. At the very beginning of his ministry, what did John shout out? Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Jesus, the final, the last sacrifice for sin. So in that moment, these Hebrew slaves experience grace. Undeserved favor, protection. Just on the basis of trust. Not on the basis of anything they've done. On the basis of faith. Not works. Please understand, there were still no rules here. You remember when the Passover happened? Were there any rules? Had the Ten Commandments been given? Had anything like that happened? No. Here's what you need to hear today. When God walked onto the world stage, the first thing he did was demonstrate, I am God. And all other gods are false and unreal. There is only one God and I'm him. He demonstrated his power. But the second thing he did was he demonstrated his grace and his mercy. You can trust me. And if you trust me, I will redeem you. I will protect you. I will save you. And then he did the most unusual thing of all. When he led them out of Egypt and provided a cloud for them to follow during the day and a pillar of fire for them to follow at night. Not because they deserved it, but because he had chosen them as a picture of what he wanted to do for all of us. And then God brought them to Mount Sinai. They finally arrive at this mountain, and all the people camp around the mountain. And the mountain is literally capped with fire at this point because God has come down and God is on top of the mountain. And the people are terrified. They won't even go near the mountain. They won't touch the mountain because they're scared stiff if they do, they'll die. Because this amazing God who has demonstrated all this power to them is now within reach. He's within touching distance. And they're petrified. And God reveals himself on this world stage in an extraordinary way. And we read the Lord came down on top of the mountain, on top of Mount Sinai, and called Moses to the top of the mountain. And God was saying, this powerful, immense God who could do all these incredible things was now saying, I want to be with you. I have come down. Didn't have to. But I have come down to be with you right now. This is as close as I can get right now. Because some other stuff is going to happen for us to get really close together. But until that happens, this is as close as I can come to you. A holy God and an unholy people. And God invites Moses up, and that's where he gave him the law. Now don't miss this. God gave Moses the law for a people he had already redeemed. The law was not given as a means to get into relationship with God. God had already entered into relationship. And this is where Christians, even Christians, get it wrong all the time. Here's what God said to them before he gave them the law. Listen to this, and this is a key phrase. I am the Lord. What's that? Your God. Hang on. You can't be our God yet because you haven't given us the rules. When we've got the rules and we obey the rules, then we'll be your God. Then you'll be our God and we'll be your people, right? But we need the rules first. No, he hadn't given the rules. I am the Lord your God before that. I'm the God who rescued you, who redeemed you from the land of Egypt, the place of your slavery. But God, you can imagine those Hebrews saying, but God, so far, all we know, we only know your name. And we don't even understand what it means. I am. What's that? We don't know anything about you. That's okay, says God. But we don't know what you're like and we don't know the rules. That's okay. I am the Lord. I am the Lord, your God, before you keep the first rule, I am the Lord your God. But we're not a very good people. It's not the issue. I have chosen you. I have redeemed you. I have rescued you. You are my people. Before you obey any rules, you are mine. I chose to accept you based on the fact that I wanted to. Not based on the fact that there's anything particularly good about you. And I want the world to know, because now I'm going public, not just with my power, but I want the world to know I'm a God of grace. That's who I am. Not just a God of power and of plagues and of amazing wonders. I'm just a God of fire on a mountaintop. I am your God. And I'm your God because I want to be. Not because you're good enough. We always associate Moses with the law, don't we? Moses, law. There are a lot of other things going on at that time. I am the Lord your God who rescued you. Who's already rescued you. And then he's the first commandment. You must have no other God before me. Let me just ask you, if you're a Hebrew at the time and you've just seen God do 10 unbelievable miracles in the land of Egypt, demonstrations of absolute awe-inspiring power, making a mockery of the gods that everybody believes in at the time. If you've seen Pharaoh's army, the superpower of the day, his chariots and his warriors drowned en masse in the Red Sea by this God. If you've just been led by pillars of cloud by day and fire by night to a mountain capped with fire and smoke and the earth is shaking, here's the question. How many of us would say, no other gods but you? Now, I'm going to have to think about that. How many of you would stop there and say, no, I'm not, can I take time out and just think, do I want you as my God? Maybe there's another one somewhere else, a better one, bigger one. maybe, yeah, could we just hang on a minute, Lord? I need to think this through. How many people would say, I have to think about that. No other gods before me. Don't miss this, because it's a pattern of a relationship with God. When God went public in Moses' day, this is what he wanted us to know. Yes, I'm powerful. Yes, I'm the God who initiates relationship with mankind. I'm a God of boundaries and rules. But when you understand who I am on the mercy and grace side of things, you'll have no problem surrendering to the things I ask of you. You'll have no problem when you understand the sort of God I am. Powerful, yes, but gracious too. Accepting you as you are. Then you'll be able to respond to my rules. And that same God we read about in the New Testament, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the God of Moses. No other gods but me. We'd be crazy to say anything else. When God stepped onto the world stage, this is what he demonstrated. This is what he said to the world. I'm a God of immense power, but I'm also the God of grace and of undeserved mercy. I'm the God who knows what he's doing, and he's got a plan, and it does work out. And even though your circumstances make you feel God has forgotten me, don't you believe it? God has a plan for this world and everything in it, every little move. And he doesn't make mistakes, and he hasn't forgotten you. And he's a God of forgiveness, a God of grace and love and forgiveness. It's a wonderful story. The problem is with all of us is that there's something in me and you that wants to earn our way too often. And we forget the order in which it happened. First I redeem you, then I'm going to put some boundaries in because I'm your dad and I love you. And what dad doesn't put boundaries in for his kids? But the boundaries don't make you his kids. Behaving according to the boundaries don't make you his kids. You're his kids. And that's why the boundaries are there. We get it the other way around, don't we? If I behave, if I obey the rules, if I earn this, God, then I'll be your kid. I'll be your son and your daughter, and you'll love me. And I'll gain acceptance by performance. And God says, that's not what I've been saying since the day of Moses. Since the day of Moses, I've said, first, you're mine, and I love you, and I redeem you. And because I love you, I'm putting in some boundaries. To protect you because you're mine and I love you. And we get it all the way around. And so often in churches we've said, you know, you have to first behave. First you have to behave and then you believe and then you'll belong. Rubbish. God says you belong. You're mine. And as you learn what I'm like, then you'll start to behave because you'll love me back. And you'll believe, as you believe in who I am, you'll start to respond back to me in appropriate ways. That's the way it works. And so often we get it the wrong way around. Behave first. It's rubbish. It's not the gospel. Jesus says, come as you are, and I will save you. And we'll work on the behavior bit later. As you get to know me, as you get to love me, that won't be a problem. But first, know this, you're mine. It's all about grace. Any time a church loses track of God's power and his grace and mercy that precede the law, they lose track of what God tried to broadcast 1,500 years before Jesus. We lose it. God says, this isn't about, do I love you? These laws are because I love you. The law is your response of obedience because now you trust me. Now you're grateful. Now you've seen who I am. Now you follow. But first you see who I am. That's all. The same God who delivered Israel from Egypt is the same God who sent his son into our world. Not with 10 more commandments. You notice that? Not with another bunch of rules. But to die on your behalf as the final payment for sin. And who says to you today, just what Moses said to the people all those years ago, if you will just place your trust in my death for your sin, you'll be delivered from your slave. If you would place your trust in the Lamb of God, then Passover happens for you. And if you, like the Israelites, put your trust in the blood of the Lamb painted over your head and around you, just like them, the angel of death will never touch you. I will pass over and you will not be judged. Not because you've done anything, but because you're mine and because you trust me. If you put your faith in the blood of Christ, judgment passes over you. Not because you're good, but because God is faithful. Because God honors his promises. Is it any coincidence that the Passover and the cross of Christ are identical incidents separated by 1500 years of history? No. It's the same story from Moses to Jesus to Revelation. It's the same story again and again. The story of redemption. And we're going to celebrate that this morning. We're going to take bread and we're going to take wine. And we're going to remember the Passover. We're going to remember God's grace to us. And the reason I'm his is not because I'm good enough to be his. The reason I'm his is because I trust what Jesus has done for me. It's about what he's done, not what I've done. And no amount of behaving will change that. It's true for all of us. It's the same message. So we're going to share bread and wine. We're going to remember that on the night that Jesus was betrayed, it was the Passover, the night before Passover. Jesus took bread. And when he'd broken it, he gave it to his disciples and he said, "This is my body broken for you." Passover lamb. Broken for you. And then he took some wine and he said, "This is my blood. The blood of the Passover lamb which is covering you. Above you and around you. And protecting you. And if you trust in what I've done, you're in. No other action necessary. That will come as you love me. You'll start to believe me and you start to trust me and you start to do stuff that you wouldn't have done before. But right now, just trust what I've done for you and you're in. You're mine." That's what Israel did. They became, and the God could say at Sinai, "I am the Lord your God because you trusted me. Because you just trusted me."